Hi, welcome to the Echo Podcast, where we discuss how our hearts and minds can be an echo of God's heart and mind and what that even means in this world. We are Pastor Dan Sinkhorn and Adrian Terullo from Shiloh Church of Jasper, Indiana, and we've gone pulpit to podcast. We hope you enjoy today's episode where we discuss motherhood, a mother's legacy. So Pastor Dan, this past week, Sunday, was Mother's Day, and you gave a great sermon once again about motherhood. Mm-hmm. And gave us the scripture of Paul, the Apostle Paul, is writing to his son, Timothy, correct? Mm-hmm. And he's writing about Timothy's grandmother and mother, and their names were Lois and Eunice. So would you mind telling us a little bit about that passage and why you chose it?
Sure. I joined, no doubt, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pastors worldwide who use that passage for Mother's Day. The irony is there have been a lot of Sundays, a lot of Mother's Days in my career where I sort of forgot Mother's Day was today and I'd already planned something else for the topic. And so I didn't preach about mothers. And it went over fine. Just in case some of you are listening and going, the nerve of that man. Well, you know, as long as you give them their due on Mother's Day, mothers are pretty cool about it. But I try over the last few years to be more intentional about preaching about motherhood on Mother's Day and about fatherhood on Father's Day. And now I remember why I maybe subconsciously avoided it, because, man, is it a dangerous topic in this time. You know, when you preach about Mother's Day, and I'm going to come back to that scripture, but when you preach about mothers on Mother's Day, you risk offending people who want to be mothers but haven't been able to bear children yet, maybe never have. I know of certain church members who told me they wouldn't be in church on Sunday because it's too painful for them, because they wanted to be mothers and couldn't. And I know people who have bad experiences with their mothers growing up. I have plenty of people in church whose mothers have died and they're still grieving, and so they don't necessarily want to talk about mothers. And then you add to that all the modern problems of what is a mother, what is a woman, and whether or not a person is born with the necessary hardware to be a mother, they can still decide that they're a mother, or they can still decide that they're a woman. And I mean, it's just complicated. And I'm not mocking any of those people. I'm simply saying, you talk about dangerous waters for a pastor to wade into. Get specific about something like motherhood or fatherhood, and you're in dangerous territory, because there are so many people whose feelings are raw and ready to be offended. And the passage that is used most frequently is the Paul's commendation of Eunice and Lois, because it's one of the few places in the Bible that speaks very specifically to the influential role that those two women played in the development of a Christian disciple. Now, obviously, there are lots of great women in the Bible. The Bible is full of fantastic stories about women. And some of those women are pretty amazing characters and fascinating, you know, for their personalities and so forth. And then there's this remarkable woman named Mary, who was the mother of Jesus, who is pretty awesome. So we got a lot of women we can celebrate in the Bible, but nothing celebrates the role of motherhood and grandmotherhood quite as succinctly as the passage from 2 Timothy, where the Apostle Paul says, you know, I'm so grateful for you. You are my son in the faith. I raised you as my disciple, and now I feel like you're my son, the son of faith. And Paul is just really proud of Timothy. And we don't really have any way of knowing what became of Timothy, but if Paul's estimation of him is any indication, Timothy must be one of the most influential and important leaders in the early church, because Paul had such a high regard for him. But he credits Timothy's grandmother and mother for getting him off to a good start. And that's what that passage is about. And I mentioned on Sunday that we don't really know where Dad and Grandpa figure into all of this. And it would not be wise to over-speculate about it, because it could be that they were just working for a living. So, because that's the way ordinary, typical home life went for, well, most of human history. And I'm not trying to make a statement about what ordinary, typical home life is, but if we're going basically on the numbers, well, the vast majority of homes and households throughout human history have featured a man who is hunter-gatherer and a woman who is nurturer and caregiver.
Right.
So Dad goes off early in the morning to make sure that they have food to eat and shelter, and he works with other men to accomplish that, and the women stay at home and work together to accomplish the child rearing and the basic fundamental needs of children and households. And that's the way it works throughout most of human history and throughout most of the world today. Obviously, there are notable exceptions, and there are also abusive situations where women are abused for being, you know, weaker than men, and there are roles fulfilled by men that don't honor the role of fatherhood and manhood. And so what I tried to talk about on Sunday was just the most honorable aspects of womanhood. And I wanted it to be as much about women in general as it was about mothers and grandmothers. Because what I believe with all my heart is that there are lots of women out there who fulfill these really uniquely feminine roles in people's lives that could be done by males and are often done well by males, but not typically. And so there are mothers out there in spirit, lots of them. You know, my daughter is a educator, and she's also not a physical mother. She's never had her own children, but she has hundreds of children over the years of her career who have come to her for the same nurture and special attention and care that they would get from a mother. And I'm not saying men can't do that, but the experience is different, typically, between men who serve in roles like that and women who serve in roles like that. And likewise, someone like you who's a physical therapist, you know, there are men who do physical therapy and there are women who do physical therapy, but for the most part, without trying to overstate this and put myself in a difficult position with people who nitpick, right? But for the most part, I'll wager that as you spend your hours every week at the physical therapy place, the experience that the clients have with the male therapist versus the female therapist is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so my argument Sunday was, is, you know, like it or not, God made women unique, and up against men, they're an entirely different creature. And that's a good thing. And that's a good thing, because the world is incomplete without both. And so I really went out of my way to celebrate womanhood. And then in particular, to thank those women who have been mothers, and to recognize that motherhood is a unique and special gift that comes with a womb. And of course, you know, I heard someone say amen while I was out there, and I cringed a little bit, like, oh, come on, let's not get into that argument. Let's not go there. We're not hating anybody who feels they're a woman even though they don't have the hardware, right? What we're saying is that you can't get around the fact that there is a unique, one-of-a-kind type of motherhood that comes with the necessary equipment to bear a child. And there's no way you get around that. You know, you will be hard-pressed to find a woman who has carried her own child to term in her womb who doesn't have an entirely intimate and individual experience of motherhood that can only be had that way. That doesn't mean that lots of adoptive mothers don't become fantastic moms. It doesn't mean that you can't love your children the same way or as much as a woman who carries a child. But you can't get around the fact that this carrying a little person inside you that has started with a microscopic something and becomes a little person that you then have to extract from your body in a very painful but glorious exercise. It has its effect on a woman.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that as a man. This is one of those statements that a man can't make without sounding a little weird, but it's like, you know, I'm a little envious in a way that my wife had that, you know, because I guarantee as soon as that baby came out and they put it in my arms, I felt like a dad. And it changed my life forever, you know, and knowing that this is in some part my child. This baby didn't happen without my contribution. But I still can't be the one who carried that baby inside my body, and I can't be the one who's going to nurture that baby by nursing that baby, you know. So I was trying to talk about both things on Sunday. I was trying to say how wonderful womanhood is and how it's not defined by whether you can have a baby or not. On the other hand, motherhood is pretty awesome because you do, you know. But then I'm perfectly open and very flexible about talking about how parenting is accomplished and the importance of good parenting regardless of how it happened, right? You know, I don't want to cut people off and make them think that this was a, you know, I was simply trying to fulfill my responsibility and my sense of duty to Mother's Day. A secular holiday that was imposed upon the pastors of a bazillion churches for however long that holiday's been around. And there is very few places on the planet where motherhood is celebrated on Mother's Day like it is at church. You know, I've noticed, I'll close this comment with this remark. I have noticed, since I've been a pastor for now 28 years, I have noticed that Mother's Day is declining in significance at church. But I can tell you that 25 years ago, I expected as big a crowd on Mother's Day as I had on Easter Sunday, because there was nothing that told mom she was loved like having all of her children and her grandchildren lined up in the pew with her at church. Because the vast majority of the moms wanted those kids with them in Sunday church. If you asked mom 25 years ago, what would you like for Mother's Day? She would say, come to church with me. Again, I know that's not exclusively a Christian thing, but since we're in a Christian ministry talking in a Christian context, all I can say is wow. Mother's Day in church is a big deal, and it isn't as big as it used to be because those moms are dying off, but gosh, it was a big deal for a long time because, you know, this is what mom wanted worse than anything, was for you all to be there so she could sit proudly with her corsage on her shoulder, you know, on her lapel, and so she could sit there proudly with all her children and grandchildren lying down the pew, and because that was the tribute to her motherhood, you know, and now, you know, it's scary to even try to preach a sermon that lauds women and motherhood on a Mother's Day. And it's actually a little less dangerous on Father's Day because nobody's paying attention on Father's Day anyway.
Really?
I'm not kidding. As much as I anticipated a huge crowd on Mother's Day, I also anticipated a lower than average crowd on Father's Day. Because typical fathers throughout my career, what they wanted worse than anything on Father's Day was to sleep in and not have to go to church. And to have hamburgers and hot dogs for supper that afternoon. I mean,
Yeah.
Father's Day doesn't get the same celebration that Mother's Day does. And in our society, mothers are more highly regarded than fathers. It's true.
Yeah. I feel like you're touching on a couple really important and yet sensitive topics, right?
Yes.
And but it's important to be able to talk about and flesh things out and say, you know, mothers are honored and highly valued. And without our mothers, where would we be?
Right.
Right. And so it's important to say, like, wow, we respect our mothers. Thank you, Lois and Eunice. Thank you to our mothers. And yet there is so much sensitivity and I'll say toxicity around the idea of motherhood in our culture today. And I don't know to what depth I can really speak on that, just because I kind of stick to my corner and my beliefs in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I would be open to discussions about what it means to be a mother, what it looks like to be a mother, you know? And I think we have a lot of fantastic motherly, maternal figures at Shiloh. Like, there's a lot of very strong, very loving, very nurturing women who go to Shiloh. And a lot of them I look up to like a mother figure
mm-hmm.
for me. And I guess something else that is so important to me about being connected to a healthy, faith-filled community with a bunch of mother figures is that as awesome as my own mom might be, she's a human being, right? So she has certain idiosyncrasies. I always don't know if there's an in there or not. Mm. Anyway, that are incomplete. I mean, we can
right.
just say that, right? Like, no human being is totally complete. And yet, when you get in this this community of a bunch of women, I can look to these women and see truly what it means for them to be a mother and how their mother figures for me. And everyone has their own little like spice, their own way of doing that and loving the Lord through it. And that's something that I very much value in our Shiloh community. And I wonder how much the culture has changed from what you've said like 25 years ago. Because something that I noticed this past Mother's Day was that there were a lot of families who weren't in church,
mm-hmm.
but I know that they weren't there because they were going to the church of their mother or
right.
grandmother, right? Like
right.
The, it
they
was,
were filling someone else's pew
right.
for
yeah,
grandma.
Exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I get it.
And there were a lot of families, too, of like the older women in our church whom I rarely, if ever, see their family, and their whole family was lined up in the pew.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Like, I do think that it's changing, but I wonder how much it's changing. I don't know. It's hard for me to say.
Well, you know, gosh, there's so many things I would like to unpack with you on that. As I often do, I'll start with the high altitude, you know, that in our society right now, we have these layers of discussion around things like motherhood. You know, there are people who don't even want to include sex and gender in the discussion. They don't even like the term motherhood. They just want to say parenthood. Okay, I'm really not qualified to argue with those people. I have my perspective and my particular beliefs, and I don't consider my beliefs hateful or hostile towards the people who disagree with me. I simply don't relate to their perspective. I simply cannot go where they go. And guess what? There's plenty of people like that in the world, you know? There are lots of people who I have cultural separation from because their whole worldview is different from mine. I don't mean that they're wrong because mine is different from theirs. I just don't know how to relate to them. And if I have to, I will find a way. But if I don't have to, there's a pretty good chance there will always be separation between me and my worldview and other people and their worldview. So there's that layer of the discussion of what motherhood is and what Mother's Day is all about. You know, if those people are in charge, we probably won't have a Mother's Day in another 20 years because they'll just say, That's an outdated idea. Whatever. Then you have this kind of Judeo-Christian worldview where we have more or less traditional roles assigned. Motherhood is for women and fatherhood is for men. But there are effeminate men out there and there are very masculine women out there. And so sometimes the roles are flipped. I knew a family many, many years ago where the man was very effeminate and the woman was very masculine. And they raised their children and had a wonderful life and everything was fine, but the roles just seemed oddly out of place. But it worked. Mm-hmm. And it's not my life, it's their life. So there's all kinds of discussion you can have about these kinds of things. And I talked a lot about the ability to bear a child and carry it to term and all that. And yet, the reality that we all have to deal with is that there are people out there who have the ability to carry a child, and they have, but they're still terrible mothers and they never embrace motherhood. And the first thing they want to do is try to figure out how not to be burdened by this child that they've been burdened with for the last 9 months or 6 months or whatever of difficulty. You know, it's like there are plenty of people out there who, just because they had the physical capability of fathering a child or bearing a child in their womb, never rise to the call that goes with that. And some children are raised in terribly dysfunctional situations because the parent never rose to the calling. You know, for me, when I became a dad, it was transformational because I felt a sense of duty and responsibility that went with that. And I thought, well, I don't feel qualified and I don't feel capable, but I'm going to find my way there as long as it takes, because I think there's nothing more important that I can do with my life than to be a good dad. And I know that starts with being a good husband. So this was the paradigm upon which I built my awareness that I was going to be a father. You know, okay, I'm going to be a dad. Then this is how it's going to be. And I spent the rest of my life from that day forward dedicating myself to it. And the funny thing is there's so much about my life now that is shaped by the desire to be a good husband and father. Even these conversations I have with you, it's informed by my worldview that being a good father and a husband is the most important thing I can do with my life. And everything else is filtered through that. So being a good pastor or being a good employee in some other undertaking is informed by desire to be a good husband and father, you know. And so that's how I've approached it. And I'm very aware that there are men who will never rise to that. And there are women who will never rise to that. And yet somebody calls them dad and somebody calls them mom. So there are people then who fill those gaps in our lives, which is why I go back to people like my daughter and you who at this point, you know, don't have children of your own, but you are in every way filling those gaps for people. You, as our youth minister, you're filling the gaps, and you're filling it in your uniquely feminine way because you're a woman. And your approach to filling that gap meets a need that these kids have that, you know, they may be conscious of or they may not be conscious of. And so I think even those of us who could say we were raised in good homes by great parents would still have a certain list of people that we would think of as spiritual mothers and fathers. You know, the Apostle Paul called Timothy his spiritual son. I don't think that that took the place of Timothy's natural father, and because we don't know what the story is there, we can speculate just as realistically that Timothy's father was a great guy. But he was just a guy, you know, a man of his times. He just wasn't that in the picture because he was doing what men of his time did. You know, we don't know. But we do know that there's room in Timothy's story for a spiritual father. And so we all have this ability to be spiritual mothers and fathers to people. And so what you say about the church, I think, is absolutely true. There are lots of people in this church, women who give you a great example of what great women do, what good Christian women do. And I say that, and then in my heart and mind, I feel a little bit of a twinge, because there's been plenty of people in my years as a pastor who were more than willing to go around wagging their finger at people, telling them what a good Christian woman should be like and what a good Christian man should be like. And they're really not the best people to be doing that, you know. So here's the thing. And you take this and do what you want with it. In my opinion, the secret to great motherhood or great fatherhood or great spiritual leadership that looks like motherhood or fatherhood, it all comes down to this. You have to be a great Christian. And the way to be a great Christian is to be entirely submissive to Christ. So if you get right down to it, the worst parents are usually people who never give up their need to fulfill themselves for the sake of anyone else. The one thing all parents have in common is that they have been assigned responsibility for a person, a little person, who at the beginning is utterly and completely dependent on them, but they never stop being dependent on that person. And from that little one's point of view, from the day they emerge from the womb, from the day they, you know, nurse from their mother, there is a sense that that person is responsible for them. You know, the infant that's 3 months old knows instinctively that that mother is responsible for them, whether that mother wants to be responsible for somebody or not. And so when you look at a lot of the childhood, adverse childhood experiences, and you look at how that traumatizes kids, and then they become adults who are still bearing that trauma, it usually starts with their instincts being denied. Their instincts are being denied. Their instincts tell them that they should be able to count on their mother. And on that instinctual level, they're betrayed, because mother leaves them in the apartment or in the house or whatever for hours on end while mother goes doing whatever mother wanted to do for herself. Now, many times this has to do with addiction and other really horrible dysfunctions. But what I'm getting at is that, to use that extreme example to make my point, to a lesser extent, there are plenty of people out there who feel betrayed by their mother or father because their instinct said that they should be able to count on mom or dad. And they learned painfully that they couldn't. And they're traumatized by that. And it doesn't, this is incomplete, so this is difficult to talk about because I know I'm incomplete here. So the parent who says, so are you saying my kid, you know, has a right to be mad at me because I didn't give them everything they wanted? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it starts, I'm talking about during the developmental years. I'm talking about at the very earliest stages of life. The child has their instincts betrayed because hunger goes unmet, because pain isn't managed, because they're cold and nobody gets them warm, or they're warm and nobody helps them get comfortable. They're frightened and nobody's there to comfort them. You know, it's like these really fundamental needs aren't met. And then when they get older and they become more willful, then they start testing their parents to see whether they're going to get their needs met. And this is where parenting becomes a real skill and a real art form, because now you got this 2 to 5 or 6 year old who's trying to find the boundaries around their own personhood. And the parent has got to be there to define them. And lovingly defined boundaries say, you have a right to expect certain things from me, but you have no right to expect certain other things from me. And so you're defining those boundaries for them in love. You're saying, I'm going to let you fall on your nose because that'll be a good learning experience for you, but I'm not going to let you burn the skin off your hand and not be able to use your hand for the rest of your life. You know, like I'm willing to let you stumble and fall periodically so that you learn certain critical things about life, but I am going to protect you against major trauma and you know, permanent disfigurement or whatever you want to call it, you know. And so parenting is, from the very moment that child is born, is a process of letting go, but it's a process of launching too. Like parenting, really selfless parenting, is about systematically releasing this person into their own personhood and eventually their own adulthood. Now, when you think about the sense of betrayal that some of us feel because our parents didn't come through for us, as at the risk of oversimplifying it, I would say that a parent who is unduly selfish during the child-rearing years is betraying their child's trust. But a child who expects more than is reasonable from a parent is a child who hasn't been nurtured very well in the boundaries of personhood. I mean, this is heavy stuff, and I'm talking like some kind of child psychologist or something, and I'm not.
Yeah.
I read a lot of books. I've raised my own kids. I'm talking about my own instincts here, and my instincts that are informed by my Christian worldview. Because the Bible pretty clearly states to us that God gives us the freedom of will to be in a similar way to God, self-determining. But he also goes out of his way to tell us about the cause and effect of things, which we talked about last week. He goes out of his way to say, if you do this, then this will happen. God is the originator of the if-then statement. Long before we ever had computers, God was saying, if this, then that. And so God gives you a freedom of will, but he also tells you, do not eat from that tree. And if you do, there will be consequences. And then when they do, he says, now these are the consequences. But I'm still here. And then it's this never-ending list of if-then statements. So if we're looking for a parenting role model, there's none better than God himself. And God is saying, I want you to have the mind, you know, God says, I've given you a mind like my own so that you can determine your own purpose and sense of being. You know, you're going to define your personhood to a certain extent on your own, just as you should. But you need help along the way. And what a parent is charged with doing is being that help along the way to launching a person to complete personhood. So my oversimplified view of things is parents who are caught up in sin, and I mean in the big word sense of self-determined, like not self-determination, but self-will, you know, like sin is when you put your fleshly desires ahead of God's glorious and divine will, and which is why we're all going to fall short of the glory of God, because none of us can completely 100% please God 100% of the time except Jesus. But sin then is basically sort of selfishness, and certain sins are like selfishness out of control to the extreme. And other sins are more, you know, subtle, but they really are just expressions of wanting what I want, no matter who it costs. Well, the problem with being a parent, especially of a young child, is every time you put your wants and needs ahead of that child's wants and needs, there's a price to pay. Sometimes that parent is utterly and completely within their rights to say, I need a little me time, because if I don't, it's going to adversely affect how I serve you. Mm. You know what I mean? Like there's the difference, right? Parenting to go well, it has to be the most unselfish thing you ever do. Raising a child has to be the most unselfish thing you ever do. The problem that people will have with what I'm saying is that they're going to assume that I'm thinking that somehow they should never do anything for themselves, that they should never have any fun or pleasure because their children are everything. No, that's unhealthy too. Yeah. In fact, I've seen some really lousy parents who selfishly gave their children everything they wanted. Because if you're trying to be the best parent in town and you think the way to do that is by giving your kid everything they want, if you decide that your kid is going to have the nicest car on the school parking lot when they turn 16, I have a feeling that's more about you than your kid.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of parents will say, you know, when you have enough money, you can get a car. Meanwhile, ride the bus. And they're actually probably doing parenting better. So parenting that is done for selfish reasons isn't very good parenting. Absentee parenting that's done because of selfish reasons isn't very good parenting. So some people can be very attentive parents, but everything they do is about them, not the child. Some people can be really unattentive parents because everything they do is about them, not the child.
Right.
I mean, it goes both ways. You know, the parenting has to be an unselfish business. It has to be done with the love that God has for God's people. He gave everything he could give in order to save them. So parenting is definitely about laying down your life. But in a healthy environment, it doesn't damage your own self-development. Heck, being a parent made me a better man than I ever would have been had I not become a parent. Being a parent taught me to do and be things that I never would have tried. You know, so it's like, it isn't like I didn't get plenty out of parenting. But the one thing I always knew as I was raising my children was is that taking care of them and taking care of their mother was the most important thing I could do with my life. I don't know what you do with that, but I would say that that's when we're not talking so much about having a womb or not. It's right there where we're not really talking about whether you raise your naturally born child and conceived child or you raise an adopted child. It really comes down to unselfishly dedicating your life to the well-being of another. And when it comes to children, that has exponential potential impact. You know, you raise one child that well, and again, it doesn't mean that they have the best grades in the school. It doesn't mean that they have the straightest teeth in the school. It doesn't mean that they go to the best college or become president. You could be a really good parent who raises a child who has some nondescript job somewhere that doesn't seem to amount to much in the grand scheme of things, but you're changing the world because you created a person of good character. You raised a person with good character. And every little thing that they do, every life they touch, is an extension of the good character that you nurtured in them. And their good character comes because of the outpouring of your good character. And so when you think about people who have negative things to say about their parents, a lot of times it comes down to the fact that they feel betrayed by their parent on some really fundamental level, and they feel as though their parent was not there for them, even if they were always around, because everything the parent said or did was more about me than you.
Well, I can't speak to being a mother, but I can speak to being a caregiver. And I think what you're saying is 100% true. When you're pouring yourself out for other people and you're working to build character and to fill them up and to help them in any way that you can, it is important to take care of yourself. Something I'm quickly learning is if you don't take care of yourself, also, maybe not first, but also, then you're not filling the cup that you're subsequently pouring out of.
Yep.
So you're constantly pouring out of this empty cup, And what good are you to anyone if you're just a shell of yourself? Mm-hmm. So I think it is important to, I don't know, I don't like the word self-care. I just don't like it because of the connotations that it has. But it is important to care for yourself in the way that you need. And everyone's different. I'm not the spokesperson for bubble baths and massages and, you know, things like that. I mean, granted, I do work in physical therapy and I think massage is great. But it means taking a moment of silence if you need to. It means checking in with yourself. Mm-hmm. How am I doing today? What do I need today? Because how am I presenting myself to the world? How effective am I in what I'm trying to communicate and what I'm trying to do? How's my memory? Mm-hmm. How's my sleep? You know, these are indicators of health. How's my hydration? How's my nutrition? These are really important questions to ask to make sure that you are on target. And so mothers, don't feel guilty about caring for yourself, right?
Right.
Like, of course you've been tasked to take care of these people that you're raising, right? But care for yourself too. And don't feel bad about it. Now, unless you're shirking your child and their needs, well, like you said. But
I mean, we're dancing around a very difficult topic from the minute we started, but what I hear you saying, Adrian, is really just that self-care and the misuse of that ideology has led to a lot more selfish behavior. And that we live in a society that is bombarding us with messages that say things like, you deserve, mm-hmm. you're entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to be a Christian is to understand that if you get what you deserve, it's hell. To be a Christian is to understand that the only thing you're entitled to is God's wrath. To be a Christian is to understand that grace gives you something you don't deserve and nullifies something you're entitled to and replaces it with a gift that is pure grace. So good parenting starts with a grace-filled mindset, a Christian worldview that says, I love this child unconditionally, and it doesn't matter what they do. Even if they betray me, I will love them. For their sake, I will punish and correct them, but only as much as it takes to put them on the right path. I will not beat my child because I'm angry, because that's selfish. I will not scream and yell at my child because I'm angry. That's selfish. On the other hand, if it seems to strategically suggested to raise my... I'll just give you an illustration rather than just make this crazy statement. There was a time I remember distinctly telling my dear bride that our son was out of line. He was like 14 years old and he was out of line about something. And I just could tell he wasn't taking me seriously. And I told her, I said, I'm going to have to go back and yell at him. And she said, okay, I understand. I said, I'm not angry. I got no rage in me whatsoever. I'm not mad. I am completely in control. I am just sensing that the only way he's going to understand this is serious is if I do something that gets his attention. So I walked back to his room, you know, did what actors do, you know, put in my face, you know, and then I went, son, I need to talk to you about something. And it really got through to him. And I walked back out to the kitchen and high-fived my wife and I said, it worked. And I wasn't angry.
Yeah.
I was just being strategic. And that's what I mean by that. Like, see, there's a difference between interacting with other people with selfish motives and interacting with other people filled with grace. That is to say, you are filled with grace. You have the grace of God within you and your interactions with other people. Now, sometimes even at this stage in my life, people can push the right buttons and make me angry. Well, what I do in response to that is try to figure out how to dissipate the anger and then respond appropriately from a position of grace. And that just takes time and spiritual growth. It takes time and maturity. But really, the dumbest things we do out of fear. And fear is a very selfish response to life. It has its place, you know? It's very selfish to see something falling from the sky and run away before it lands on you and kills you. That's very selfish, but it's also appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we can react the same way to another person's behavior or to another person's decisions, and it isn't appropriate because they're triggering a fear in us that we need to responsibly process, which goes back to what you were saying about self-care. See, self-care for the sake of others and for ourselves isn't a bad thing at all. I grew up with terrible feelings of unworthiness and self-loathing, and you know, I spent a lot of my time feeling like a loser during my teens and 20s, and feeling like a failure, and feeling unworthy of love and respect, and I dealt with a lot of that. And so for me to get good counseling, for me to develop new ways to talk to myself about myself, on the surface would seem very selfish, but it was actually a very gentle and loving thing I was doing for myself. Like in my case, the pivotal moment, and it wasn't like it happened in a minute, it happened over a period of years. But for me, the turning point was recognizing that I could be my adult self caring for my wounded child self. Now, there's a whole guy named John Bradshaw really brought this to the surface years and years ago, but there's this whole wounded inner child psychology thing, and I don't have the authority to speak on it. But basically what I realized that changed my life was is that I could parent myself. That I could take that child within that was still carrying around this pain, who still took charge of my being at times when the right circumstances emerged. I could say, I'm in charge now. I won't let you down. I will care for you. And so the secret to becoming a good parent a lot of times is to learn to be a good parent to yourself, or to be a good care. Whatever, wherever you feel betrayed and let down by someone who should have given you what you needed, you as an adult can decide to take that role on. Say, okay, I didn't get help processing my irrational fear of the dark when I was a little kid, because my father mocked me and sent me away, and that only made me feel worse about myself. Now I'm an adult. What can I do about that? Well, I know as an adult that darkness is the same as daylight, except you can't see the things that are still there. So we turn off the dark, or turn off the lights in this room, it's still the same room. I just can't see. But it's still the same room. And so I can rationalize myself into being at peace with the fact that 6 feet across from me is there's a chair. And in the dark, you might still be sitting in it. I don't know. But what we do as adults then is we talk to that child and we say, hey, little me. I go by Dan. So when I was talking to my little me, I called him Danny. I'd say, hey, Danny. I'm going to take care of you now. I want you to come with me. And I literally, you know, I got a great imagination. So I literally am picturing this adult version of me walking hand in hand with this little child me. And I say, come on, I got you. And I would speak gently to myself, because that is a kind of self-care that is very enriching and changes the world for the better. You know, it really makes the world better, because you're taking away one of the dysfunctional, messed up, selfish people and replacing them with someone who's healthy and productive and can generate good things and benefit the world. So self-care can be like that. Self-medication, on the other hand, isn't that. Mm-hmm. Giving yourself whatever you want, buying whatever you want, drinking whatever you want, eating whatever you want, smoking whatever you want, swallowing whatever you want. These are all just ways that we try to mask our pain or nullify the pain and the fear that we feel about certain things. And the extent to which we use those mechanisms and our relationships to control the things that we're afraid of, that can become a very destructive thing, you know. So we try to control our children so that they don't make us feel embarrassed or ashamed. And then we don't realize that that's just children doing what children do. And the fact that I feel ashamed is my problem, not that kid's problem. So embarrassment and shame are your problem that you carry with you into parenthood. And then you find yourself blaming the child for making you feel bad about yourself. Well, how can a four-year-old make me feel bad about myself? I mean, seriously. How can an eight-year-old kid acting like an out-of-control little maniac eight-year-old be responsible for your bad feelings about yourself? But parents will do that because they haven't dealt with themselves. So one of the things I realized when I became a parent was is that I was going to have to deal with what was wrong with my thinking. I was going to have to become a healthier version of me if I wanted to fulfill my goal of being a good father and husband. So I worked on me, which might have appeared very selfish on a certain level, but I had every intention of applying this self-care and this therapeutic treatment of myself to being a better parent and father and husband. You know, that was the goal.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that makes me admirable. I'm saying that to my knowledge, my best expression, that's the way that taking care of yourself is making the world a better place. Medicating yourself, masking your pain, those aren't really making the world a better place, and they almost always cost someone. So I guess if I was going to try to sum it up in a nutshell, I'd say when you're about to do something that is for your own benefit and you're having trouble with it, you know, your conscience is bothering you. Because there's a lot of things we do we don't have to argue with our conscience over. Eating supper, you know. Well, I'm hungry, you know. On the other hand, if you eat supper while your kid's sitting across the table from you starving because you're not feeding them, case in point. But the reality is if you're asking yourself whether this spa treatment or whatever is self-care or not, I think the question is who benefits from it? I think that's the really simple question you ask yourself. You know, is my relationship with God enriched because I did this? And you got to be honest with yourself, because a lot of people are really good at lying to themselves about all kinds of things, right? But if you're honest with yourself, you say, well, does this enrich my relationship with my God? Does this enrich my relationship with my spouse? Does this enrich my relationship with my children? Does this enrich my relationship with the staff here at the church? Does this enrich my relationship with the congregation? Does it help make the world better? If it does, it's probably worth doing. If it only makes you feel good for a little while, and it doesn't enrich anyone else or serve anyone else, least of all God, it's probably not something you should be doing. I think that's my formula.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that our conversation started with motherhood and ended with like mental health care, like taking care of yourself, mm-hmm. because it's so important. And that's something that we want to start talking more about here at Shiloh.
That's our summer of, I gave it a name and I forgot now.
Oh.
A summer, summer of hope.
Summer of hope.
That's right. Yes. Summer of hope is what I named the series of messages for the next several weeks, because they're going to range from parenting to mental health. We're going to cover everything. We're going to talk about young people. We're going to talk about old people. We're going to talk about depression and anxiety. We're going to talk about narcissism. We're going to talk about everything.
It's so important to be healthy in every sense of that word, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, because I've been following this lady called Megan Marshman. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. She's an awesome Christian speaker, and she's a pastor at a church in California. And she, I saw a recent video from her, and she talked about what it means to be good. What does it mean to be good? Mm. A lot of us think, oh, well, if I'm good, I'm making good choices. I'm hanging around good people. I'm doing all of this. And she says, well, God's definition of good is different than our definition of good. And in God's definition of good, he states that good means that we model ourselves off of Christ, yeah. that we strive to be more and more in Christ's image every day. And that's what it means to be good. And so if you're looking at being a good human being a good parent, being a good son, daughter, being a good, did I say Christian already? I don't know.
Yeah.
Being a good person, you're looking at Christ. And so it's so important to look at the adverse experiences that you've had in your life and say, how is this affecting my ability to be good? Meaning, how is this impacting and how is this a barrier to me being more like Christ every day? Because that's what we're called to do, mm-hmm. to raise children, to be the face of Christ in our everyday life and to care for people in whatever capacity you've been tasked with.
Yeah.
And so looking at those spots of pain, taking your younger self by the hand and saying, let's do this, let's heal, let me show you, parenting yourself, these are huge steps towards healing and towards being good in yeah. God's sense of the word.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love it. I think this is great and so important.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, I went all over the place with you today, you know, because I sensed that it was difficult for you to figure out what you wanted to do with this topic on legacy of mothers and things. And
yeah.
And it's difficult for me too. I came out of the service Sunday feeling anxious because I said things that I thought violent people would come after me over. And, you know, it's really sad that there are people in the world who, for the sake of what they call justice and for the sake of what they call equality and fairness, have rendered a whole segment of society frightened to simply speak honestly about what they think. And it's like we're going to frighten these people into submission so they don't dare open their mouths and say anything that might contradict us. And what a terrible state of affairs. The world of ideas is big and there's plenty of room. And no one is 100% right. Even though I think I'm informed by the greatest truth that's ever been conceived, I still know that my interpretation of it is flawed. And that God is probably far more forgiving of things that I'm not than I'll ever be. You know, like there's room in my judgment for God's grace to serve people who don't share my worldview. There's room in my judgment for my own grace to guard me against judgment, you know, to like I'm not going to judge people that don't share my worldview. And I just ask them to give me the same grace, but they also need to be willing to let other ideas be heard. And out there in the world of human intellect, let the ideas flow and you choose where you want to go with that. I think that divine grace gives us the ability to enrich each other's lives without necessarily agreeing about every little thing, you know, and it's really a shame that we've created a world that is so hostile to that kind of open-mindedness, even though it's often hostile using words that suggest that their limited point of view somehow labels you as being the one hostile. Like this is the absurd state of affairs we live in nowadays. The people who are the most unforgiving and hostile are the people who are accusing others of being unforgiving and hostile. And it's like, well, let's judge you by your deeds then. Let's look at the fruit you bear. And what do you see? People running from them in fear. People stepping out of their pulpit on Sunday morning afraid of what might happen because they spoke truth in love. That's their legacy. That's the fruit they bear. And yet they claim to be the ones who are sharing or trying to create a world where everybody can feel free and loved and accepted. There's something really wrong with that logic. Yeah. And I think it comes back to what we were saying earlier about evaluating your actions and your motives, because if your motives don't enrich more than just you and some, you know, if all your motives do is medicate you or make you feel good or make you feel less pain or whatever, and they don't really serve or enrich the world in any particular way, they're probably not very good motives. The best motives will always be driven by a desire to not only enrich your life, but the lives of others through that self-enrichment. You know, I guess the simplest way I could put it is that, you know, everything I do as a pastor is really motivated by my desire to help people. I just want to help people. I don't always get it right. And I know that some of what I do to help some people doesn't help other people. But I'm helping the ones I can, and I really just want to help them. I really don't need anything in return. And I think it's really sad that we've gotten to this place in our society where you can't just try to make the world better as best you can and, you know, somehow somebody is going to accuse you of something or put you down because you don't come at it from their point of view. I don't know why that ramped up, but it's really bothered me that I was anxious about preaching a Mother's Day sermon. That's just really bothered me. Because I never used to get anxious about these things. What do you say?
Right. Yeah, you know. I can't even say I understand because I don't. But I can see in the context of today's culture why you would be anxious. It makes perfect sense to me. How am I going to be received, you know?
Yeah.
Am I saying things truly in the name of Christ, or am I saying things in the tint of today's culture? Like, that's hard.
Sure.
That's really hard. And I understand some anxiety around that.
Well, you know, as the one who really loves and wants to serve the Lord,
yeah,
I go into each message, each preaching situation saying, Lord, I only want to speak your truth in love. And if that causes me to suffer, so be it. But if I suffer because of my own willfulness and pride, well, so be it. But help me see that coming, you know, help. It's like I'm asking the Lord to make me self-aware enough to be useful to him and to not speak some untruth in the name of love, you know. And this is a very challenging part of being in a position like this, is that if you really want to serve the Lord, you will serve him by saying and doing things that make other people uncomfortable. That's just to be expected. Jesus said it will be like that. You know, don't expect people to love you for preaching my message. They won't. But there's always this self-doubt and fear that somehow I had it coming because I wasn't wise in the use of my words, because I wasn't obeying the Spirit. And I think that's where the enemy creeps in, right? And you know what? That's a very personal thing I'm talking about at the end of a mixed bag of discussion. But I think that's a good place to leave people too, is this self-care thing. Is self-care is recognizing that we're all living that dynamic in our own way. We're all trying to be good and to do good, most of us. And we're faced by a world that sends us conflicting message about what goodness is. And then we're confronted with the reality that we think we did good, but we're not sure. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so many of us face these moral dilemmas in life where we're still scratching our heads trying to decide if we did the right thing. And I think you can come closer to a place of peace if you are informed by scripture, involved in a Christian community, and you have a Christian worldview. I really believe that with all my heart. So certainly being biblically aware and being informed and part of as a part of a Christian community will definitely help you with more of your moral dilemmas. And there's people within Christian communities who are, you know, Christian idiots who don't really tell you anything worth hearing either. But in the grand scheme of things, the best way to get truth and love is from biblical worldview. And so it always comes down to this: are you serving a greater good than your own while your needs are being met? Or are you simply satisfying the cravings of your flesh? That, I think, is a pretty decent formula to start with.
Yeah. Check your pride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Ask me what sin is, and I'll just say pride.
Pride. All right. Let's wrap it there for today.
I think that's a good idea, Adrian. Thank you.
Thank you.
See y'all next time.
Bye.